If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is a History Extra production. In October 1942, Axis and Allied forces went head-to-head in the North African desert. Fighting over access to the Suez Canal and crucial oil fields, tanks and infantrymen slogged it out across sand dunes and minefields, under the command of two of the most charismatic military leaders of the war. In the fourth episode of our series on World War II's greatest battles, I spoke to the military historian James Holland about the Second Battle of El Alamein. James is the author of several books on the Second World War and also the co-founder of Chalk History Festival, which runs from the 24th to the 30th of June this year. We're offering an exclusive 15% off Chalk Festival day tickets for subscribers to either History Extra or BBC History Magazine. Check out our spring offers and all other benefits at historyextra.com/pod. Today we're going to be talking about the Second Battle of El Alamein. Why did you nominate El Alamein as being one of the greatest battles of World War II?
Well, I think it's very easy to dismiss the importance of the Mediterranean front and the southern flank from the German point of view. You know, it's very easy to confuse huge numbers of troops with strategic importance, and that's not necessarily the case. And Alamein is a really important turning point because it's the moment where the Western Allies turn the tables once and for all in North Africa, which has been playing out in a kind of sort of ding-dong back and forth series of battles of back and forth across the North African desert. And that changes after this. After Alamein, the Allies are only going in one direction, and so are the Panzer Army, the combined German-Italian army, and that's backwards. And it also marks a moment where I think sort of British forces, particularly British and Commonwealth forces, start to kind of work out how they're going to win, how they're going to defeat the Germans. So after kind of years of disappointment and the army still kind of trying to find its feet, because don't forget, the British army was very, very small in 1939 when the war began. You see this sort of sea change. That all happens with the Second Battle of El Alamein. So that's why. It's because it's a turning point, and it's because it's a turning point in terms of defeating the Germans, but also psychologically in terms of how the Allies work out how to defeat the Germans particularly.
So before we go into more detail about the battle itself, let's just stay for a moment on a bit of background context. So what exactly was happening in North Africa at the time? This is, of course, the Second Battle of El Alamein. What do we need to know about the first?
Well, it's important to understand that in September 1940, the Italians in Libya went into Egypt, where British forces, British Commonwealth forces were, attacked them. The Western Desert Forces, the Commonwealth forces were known, managed to hold the Italians. And then counterattacked that December and absolutely smashed the Italians, capturing over 130,000 Italian troops, pushing them all the way back into across Cyrenaica, Tobruk and Benghazi, and pushing them right beyond that further to the west. Then the Germans intervened, realizing that they needed to prop up their Italian ally, and that was when Rommel came. But at the same time, the Germans were invading the Balkans and Greece, so British troops from North Africa were taken to reinforce Greece. And so began this back and forth across North Africa. Of course, the arrival of German troops was also the arrival of Erwin Rommel, then only a major general, but rapidly promoted after his victories. And I suppose the kind of sort of the nadir for the British experience really came in kind of late May, June 1942, with the Battle of the Gazala Line and the surrender of Tobruk, which was a calamity and really was the nadir in British Army fortunes in the Western War, I would say. And what happens is 8th Army then scuttles back across Libya into Egypt, all the way back to the Alamein Line. And this is significant because it's about a 45-mile stretch between the coast and the Qatara Depression. And while you can send the odd vehicle into the Qatara Depression, it's got quite a steep escarpment and you can't outflank it with an army. You know, you couldn't send a kind of mobile force around there. So there is a definitive line in the desert. But it's only about 60 miles west of Alexandria. And this causes major panic in many ways with British forces in Cairo, which is where their headquarters are. Fortunately, Rommel's forces are very badly pounded as they followed up the retreating British to the Alamein Line by the air forces, by the Desert Air Force particularly. And this slows them up. The key island of Malta is also relieved from its siege to a large extent famously by Operation Pedestal. And what this means is Malta can be an offensive base again. And from there, naval forces and air forces can attack access convoys going to North Africa to supply Rommel's Panzer Army, which is this combined German-Italian army. And what happens is the British manage to hold his forces in July 1942 in the First Battle of Alamein. And then Rommel does his last offensive action, which is the Battle of Alam Halfa, which is launched on the 31st of August. But because these supply lines have been so badly hit by forces operating out of both Egypt and also Malta, he is very short of supplies. It fails. And then the British are able to prepare for their great offensive, which is going to be the Second Battle of Alamein, which is, of course, finally launched on the 23rd of October 1942. So that's the situation.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
So just to reiterate, what exactly was at stake by the time that we get to the Second Battle of El Alamein? What were the British fighting for?
Well, the British are fighting for holding on to Egypt and making sure it doesn't fall, because what you've got behind Egypt is the Suez Canal, which is a sort of key link. But also beyond that, you've got the oil fields of the Middle East. And while the oil fields of the Middle East are only fueling British efforts in North Africa and not have any wider influence, they are of vital importance to the Germans, who only have one source of real oil, which is in Ploiești in Romania, and that's it. So obviously, from a German point of view, getting to those oil fields is far more important than it is to the Allies. So that's what's at stake. But there's been a change at the top in the British. So new commander-in-chief starts at the beginning of August is General Sir Harold Alexander, who's incredibly competent, very experienced. He is the single most experienced combat commander on any side in the Second World War. You know, he's commanded troops in battle at every single rank, from second lieutenant all the way up. He's a very, very calm head. He's also got a new army commander in General Bernard Montgomery. And together, they impose a lot of kind of sort of clarity of thought. And I think that's what's been missing with the British effort. And they both decide, Alexander says, right, there will be no more reverses. This is it. We're not going any further back. We're not going to have any further reverses. What we're going to do is we're going to build up our strength until such a point that victory is almost certainly guaranteed. And then we will attack. And that's what's happening between the Battle of Alam-Halfa at the end of August 1942, which is Rommel's last offensive, into the beginning of September, all the way through to that 7 weeks further on the 23rd of October 1942.
So something else I wanted to touch on while we were talking about the preparations for the battle was the fact that it's preceded by a deception campaign called Operation Bertram. Can you tell us a little bit about what was involved in that and whether it actually worked? Did it fool the Germans?
Yeah, so Operation Bertram was masterminded by a chap called Colonel Dudley Clark, who was a deception intelligence, you know, he was a deception genius, really, and a very, very competent deception intelligence officer based at General Headquarters in Cairo. And the idea about this was to try and hide where the main attack was going to be along the Alamein line, where the main punch of Montgomery's offensive was going to take place, and to do various deception measures, which was to sort of try and make the Germans of the Axis Panzer Army believe that the main assault was going to happen in the south of the line rather than the north of the line, and to create the impression that were more armoured troops in the south and was a reality. And also to keep the Panzer Army guessing as to exactly when this attack was going to be launched. I mean, both sides, you know, it was absolutely patently clear that the Allies were going to launch an attack along the Alamein line at some point, but when exactly was not clear. And one has to say that, you know, for the most part, it did work, really, because Rommel was away at the time. He was back in Germany, which suggests that he didn't think it was about to be launched. And on the evening of the attack, which was late at night on the 23rd of October 1942, the German intelligence officers simply weren't expecting the attack at all. So there were three German armoured divisions. There was 164th Light, there was the 15th Panzer and 21st Panzer. And 21st Panzer was left in the southern half of the line, which suggests that they felt they were going to be needed by a British armoured attack in the south. So you'd have to say that for the most part, it did work, yeah.
So the British have a little bit of the element of surprise, but other than that, how did the two sides stack up, both in terms of men and boots on the ground, but also in terms of material and equipment?
Yeah, well, by this point, the Allies have a huge advantage, and that's deliberately so. What's happened since the previous November, so in the last sort of 11 months, has been the development of tactical air power, close air support, which is pioneering for the Allies. I mean, the Luftwaffe, to a certain extent, sort of emerges in the 1930s and in the Blitzkrieg years as a kind of tactical air force, there primarily to provide close air support for the ground operations. But the RAF hasn't really developed in this way. And so this is kind of new technology, and it's also honing what they've learned, picked up from the Germans, and taking it to another level. And what you see is, from the retreat from Tobruk on the 21st of June 1942, all the way back to the Alamein line, it is really the Desert Air Force and RAF Middle East which saves the bacon of 8th Army from being completely annihilated. And that air power continues to play a really, really important role in the build-up to Alamein. So they're constantly hammering German landing grounds and Italian landing grounds, attacking Axis shipping, and it's incredibly effective. And this combined air-naval effort against Axis supply lines really starts to hurt Rommel in a very big way. And the problem is that Rommel's forces are now massively overextended, because by moving back to the Alamein line, the British are very, very close to their supply base, you know, only 60 miles from Alexandria and not much more from Cairo, and lots of supply bases in the desert around there. Whereas The nearest port for the Axis forces is Mersa Matruh, which is tiny, then Tobruk, which is also tiny. You know, you're 800 miles from Benghazi or something, you know, so it's a really, really long way. And they're using half their fuel just to deliver the fuel, you know, which is not a good state of affairs. So 8th Army is about 200,000. Panzer Army Africa is around 115,000, something like that. 8th Army have got 908 field guns. Panzer Army about 200. The Axis forces have about 547 tanks. British have about 1,200. Of those 547 tanks, it's really important that it's qualified because half of them are Italian ones and they're pretty rubbish. And only 38 of those 547 are actually Panzer Mark IVs, which are the kind of sort of, you know, on a par with anything decent, and only 88 Panzer IIIs. So, you know, you're looking at about 120, which are competitive with Allied armour. That's only 10% of what the Allies have in terms of competitive armour. So that makes a big, big difference. And although there's only around sort of 500 plus RAF aircraft in the Desert Air Force and nearly 600 for the Axis, again, that needs qualifying because some of those Axis airplanes are Italians and not particularly good. And secondly, the Allied Air Forces now have kind of inexhaustible supplies of ammunition and fuel, whereas the Axis forces absolutely don't. And those are the key things. So numbers are indicative, but it's actually a worse situation for the Axis forces because of the shortages of fuel and ammunition and supplies generally.
I think that's an interesting point to make about the way that, especially the tanks sized up against each other. I think if you spoke to somebody who knew a little bit about the Second World War and you said, Alamein, okay, tell me what it sparks in your imagination. They would say probably tanks and desert, but they would also give you two names, I think, Rommel and Monty, these kind of towering figures that loom over the way the battle is remembered. Let's talk about them. And let's start with Rommel, the desert fox. So what was his reputation in North Africa? And did he live up to it when it came to this battle?
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the poster boys for the Nazi regime. You know, he's good looking and dashing and he's everything that Hitler likes. And so much that you know, he's constantly sort of charging around. He's a very visible commander. He's always at the front. I mean, he did really, really well in northern France in May and June 1940 when he was commanding the 7th Panzer Division. Very dynamic, very charismatic. As a tactical commander, i.e., you know, a frontline battlefield commander, you know, he's really, really good. In terms of big strategic picture, yeah, you know, I think he's quite good because he, you know, he understands the importance of getting to the Middle East and getting to those oil fields and all that kind of stuff. From an operational point of view, you know, he's poor. You know, he just is. He constantly allowing his supply lines to get overstretched. He doesn't really understand air power in the same way. So he's constantly loggerheads with his von Waldau, who is his Luftwaffe counterpart in North Africa. And, you know, that's his fatal weakness. He's always charging off. He believes that kind of sort of dynamism and chutzpah and kind of just going for it big time is always the answer. And, you know, sometimes you need that drive and sometimes you need a bit of caution. But, you know, to have launched Alam Halfa on the basis that three oil tankers are going to reach you and not one of them does, you know, that's problematic. And, you know, he could have stopped that. A much more sensible option would have been to have pulled back, said, OK, no, fine, this isn't working. I'm going to pull back to the kind of Tobruk, reinforced Tobruk. It would have made it very difficult for the Allies to get past that and build up his supplies at his own pace. But, you know, he's in a hurry. The Nazis in a hurry. That's unconscionable. You can't have retreats because Hitler doesn't like them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he gets sort of slightly hoisted by his own petard, to be perfectly honest. I mean, he's a fantastically interesting character. There's no question about that.
And on the other side, we have another fantastically interesting character, Monty, Bernard Montgomery. I mean, he's a leader with a bit of a controversial legacy, but what did he bring to this battle and how would you rate him as a commander?
Well, he's absolutely the right man at the right time in August 1942 when he arrives. I mean, the fact that he only does is because General Gott, who was supposed to be the new 8th Army commander, gets assassinated by the Luftwaffe while he's travelling back from forward positions up at the front to Cairo. His transport plane gets shot down quite deliberately. But Montgomery is a very, very good trainer of men. He's a meticulous planner, and he also understands the importance of getting the best out of a conscript army. So he realises that this is no longer the kind of professional army of the pre-war, that this is full of conscripts, and that what you need is clear, simple instructions, really strong physical training as well as combat training, and you need to keep the whole thing as simple as possible. And he also understands that he needs to build up strength and do a very kind of methodical, firepower heavy assault. And this is very much going to be the way of the Allies from then on, from the rest of the war. This idea that the Germans always counterattack, you always know that. So what you do is you pour fire onto them, absolutely pound them, wait for them to counter it. Then you attack forward with your armor and your infantry, wait for the Germans to counterattack, and then you pound them again. And you just sheer weight of power, firepower, gets you, bludgeons you through, and hopefully you're using steel and not your own flesh to kind of sort of bludgeon your way forward. And it's using the best assets that they have to the greatest effect. And the point is to try and kind of sort of keep your own casualties to a minimum. Of course, that doesn't mean that you're not going to have casualties. You do, and you have pretty horrendous ones. But it's a very kind of building up your strength till you're guaranteed victory. I mean, why wouldn't that be a good idea? You know, there's this sort of slight feeling that somehow it's cheating. I mean, it's just absurd. I mean, you know, you want to win, and however you win doesn't matter as long as you win. And Monty is a winner, and he, as I say, everyone in his army understands what they've got to do. He works very, very closely with the air forces in a way that previous Eighth Army commanders hadn't, and just totally gets that bigger picture. I want to put in a kind of word for Alexander, though, because Alexander is the one who says no more reverses. He's the one who sets out the vision for the build-up of forces and not to attack until you're ready. And is very much the kind of middleman who's allowing Monty to kind of, you know, he's protecting him from the impatience of Churchill. He's ensuring that he's got all the supplies he needs. He's providing sort of vision and direction at the very top. So I always feel that the Alamein victory that results is very much Alexander's as much as it is Montgomery's. But he tends to be forgotten because, you know, he's not someone who's courting publicity and courting the limelight in the way that Montgomery is.
And victory in the desert is a very different proposition than victory in, say, northern France or the Pacific. Can you tell us a bit more about desert warfare and what it really took to succeed in it at the time?
Yeah. It's difficult because, you know, you don't have a problem with storms or anything, but you've also got a largely flat environment. I mean, it's not completely flat by any stretch of the imagination. When you're talking about the Ruwaiset Ridge or the Mitteraya Ridge, you're talking about something that's kind of 30, 40 foot high over a matter of a mile and a half. So, you know, your ridge is incremental, and it's not until you're on the top of the ridge you suddenly go, oh my God, I can see for miles, and you suddenly realize you're on the top of it. Desert warfare also, because there's not much vegetation and it's mainly a kind of sandy, rocky landscape, you do have these winds whip up, and desert sandstorms can be absolutely brutal. I mean, you know, they just get absolutely everywhere. And of course, you know, sand on engines isn't a great combination, to be perfectly honest. You know, I mean, it's effectively you're sandpapering machinery to death if you're not careful. So it's a very, very brutal, very exposing environment, and, you know, can be very, very hot by day and also very, very cold by night. So you've constantly got these temperature changes as well, and you've got scorpions and bugs and all sorts of stuff. And, you know, where there's fighting, people are getting killed and people are defecating in the desert. And what this means is you also get hordes and hordes and hordes of flies, which leads to desert sores, which also just, you know, it's just deeply, deeply unpleasant. You know, every time you're trying to eat, you get surrounded by flies and so on. So it's an incredibly tough environment, and you have to just go with it. I mean, you can't fight it. You have to use what the desert brings to your advantage rather than seeing it as a kind of, you know, a further enemy to contend with.
And added to these natural challenges, we also had minefields. These were nicknamed Devil's Gardens by the Germans, and they were used basically to protect defensive positions. So if you come across a minefield, how do you go about tackling that?
Yeah, well, it's really difficult. They're very simple, they're very cheap, and they're very easy to lay. And, you know, there are millions of mines along the front between the two forces, and wire entanglements as well. Because you just can't man every single bit of space, you have to kind of sort of concentrate troops in certain areas and then surround yourself with minefields and wire. Some of them are anti-personnel, so they're kind of designed to kill infantry. But the vast majority of the really bad ones are anti-tank, you know, they're anti-vehicle. So they're more powerful and they take a heavier weight to detonate. So, you know, a soldier can walk over an anti-tank mine and be fine, but the tank then hits it. So the way to destroy them is you need a combination of engineers and you need artillery to kind of sort of blast holes. And, you know, this is one of the shortcomings of the Alamein plan, is that they're firing mainly in barrages rather than concentrations. What I mean by that is barrage, you line up your guns and they just fire, you know, each gun fires straight ahead. Whereas a concentration, you're kind of putting all your guns onto a kind of, let's say, a 200-yard stretch, and then you're going on to the next 200-yard stretch, and then the next one. That's a much more effective way of getting rid of minefields. They don't do that. So, you know, the barrage is a kind of sort of First World War era style kind of barrage. So the plan is a 20-minute barrage to start off with, concentrations, but they're not very concentrated, followed by a creeping barrage, which is the infantry move forward, and the barrage is moving forward 100 yards every 3 minutes. Well, you know, if you get behind that forward, that rolling barrage, then, you know, you're in trouble because suddenly you can be 1,000 yards behind when the barrage lifts. And that gives, the whole point is that by the time the barrage lifts, you're kind of right on top of the Germans effectively. And you just sort of, you know, they're all discombobulated and stunned by this immense barrage. And then you've got a very sort of short distance to go. But the problem is the complication is that you want to use armor, tanks and whatnot, with your infantry together to do this big punch. And the only way you can do that is by clearing channels. So you have your barrage and your concentrations, but you also have the engineers clearing these channels. It's on a 10-mile front in the north is where the main attack is going to be. And this is on two corridors, each with three lanes, each of 8 yards. Well, 8 yards isn't very wide. And that's deliberate so that your mine clearers haven't got too much work to do. But what that means is you're channeling all your armor through six lots of 8 yard wide lanes in the middle of the night with lots of battle going on. And you've got all this armor grinding through this sand. And you mix that with, you know, the dust that's kicked up by the, you know, you're grinding this sand into kind of talcum powder effectively. Then you add that to the kind of smoke of the guns and everything. And, you know, it doesn't take a lot to cause absolute mayhem. And this is what happens. And they're not able to get as far as they want to. Then dawn comes up and they're exposed in the middle of these minefields. They're halfway through the minefields, but they haven't got through the whole of the minefields. And that puts them in a very, very difficult situation. You know, so it's just it just turns into a bit of a kind of a mishmash.
You mentioned there this idea of First World War style barrages. And that's something that's been said about this battle, that in some ways it was kind of more like a World War One battle than a World War Two battle. Do you think that that's a fair characterization of the fighting? This kind of idea that it's slow and attritional?
It is slow and attritional, but I don't think it is really. You know, one of the great differences, of course, in the Second World War and the First World War is radios and the ability to be able to communicate with one another. You know, so individual tanks and units and headquarters can all, you know, as long as they've not been knocked out themselves, you know, they can communicate. One of the problems with the First World War is once you have the point of exploitation, you can't exploit it any further because you don't know where it's going to come, and you then haven't got the means of communicating, the ability to kind of rapidly reinforce that breakthrough. That's not the case here. The only thing that makes it like a First World War battle is that they're using barrages rather than concentrations. And it's very, very odd, you know, of the kind of 900 guns that Montgomery has at his disposal, you know, only 400 of those are in the northern bit, which is the main thrust. So that means that 500 aren't in that main thrust. And while he's got a two-fisted attack, you know, 7th Armored Division is attacking in the southern half of the line, and the Free French right at the bottom of the line are also launching an attack as well. Maybe it might have been better to put, say, you know, 150 guns in that southern half, still makes a huge amount of thing, but fire in concentrations. And then you could put 750 guns into that 10-mile corridor, firing concentrations, which absolutely would have smashed through the minefield. So I think that's the thing. So I think that, you know, if one's going to point a finger at Monty, tactically, he's not very creative. Operationally, he's superb. Strategically, he's very, very good. You know, he's the right person at the right time. They are going to win, come what may. You know, they're just the sheer weight of force is going to ensure that that happens. But it doesn't need to take 10 days to win the Battle of Alamein, and it does. And that's because that initial fire plan, I think, is dodgy.
So in Monty's relentless charge to victory, on the night of the 1st to 2nd of November, we have the real kicker of this battle, essentially, Operation Supercharge. So what was the plan there and how well did it go?
Just to sort of put a context out, so Operation Lightfoot is the initial bit, and that is basically stalled. So it's not like it stops, but it hasn't achieved what they hoped. In fact, actually, it's the Australians in the northern part of the northern corridor who are doing the best. So that's the bit that they decide to kind of exploit further. And basically, it's a reset. It's kind of bringing up more guns. It's concentrating more armor, and it's using, you know, it's focusing all your effort in one bit. But all this time, the Axis forces, the Germans and the Italians along the Alamein line, have been just attrited the whole time. I mean, they're you know, the guns never stop. Tanks are getting through. Infantry is getting through. They're suffering losses. Desert Air Force is continuing to pound any concentration of armour that the Germans are trying to amass in a counterattack. There's a very famous action on the 27th of October, which is still, strictly speaking, in the Lightfoot phase, called the Snipe Action, which is a kind of sort of low dome in the desert, which is sort of misnamed as the Kidney Ridge. It's not a ridge at all. It's like a hollow. And the 2nd Rifle Brigade are operating. They've been hastily retrained in 6-pounder anti-tank guns. And when the Germans start massing their armor, the Germans in town start massing their armor for a counterattack, they're already there. They've arrived overnight and they're in position and they just hammer them. And by the end of the day, there's kind of over 60 Axis tanks, which are kind of left smoldering on the battleground. When you haven't got very many tanks in the first place, that's a big hit. That's the problem. And so you're just grinding them down. So when Operation Supercharge launches on the 1st of November, the 8th Army have had this chance to kind of take a beat, so to speak, and take a deep breath and then charge again with kind of sort of renewed energy. And meanwhile, the Axis forces, the Panzer Army, the Italians and the Germans have had just no chance to kind of pause at all and are already in a pretty parlous state. They're in a pretty parlous state on the 23rd of October when the battle launches. So they've just run out of steam, basically. So this is the event that kind of finally drives it forward. Rommel's now back in charge. He realises the game is up on the 2nd of November, asks permission to withdraw. Hitler refuses. But by the 3rd of November, they're withdrawing anyway because they've got no choice. I mean, you know, and it's game over. And they've been absolutely smashed. I mean, the whole point of the Alamein battle is not just to break through the Alamein line. It is to absolutely destroy the Panzer Army Africa. And to all intents and purposes, they do. I mean, they retreat in drips and drabs, but they are absolutely hammered. It's an immense victory.
So what was ultimately behind this immense victory, do you think? Was it kind of Monty's ability to focus on operations? Was it the fact that there was this sheer weight of material and men behind them? Or was it a combination of it all?
Yeah, it's a combination of it all. It's a steady hand. I mean, there was an awful lot of sort of generals at war going on until Monty and Alexander take over. You know, everyone's sort of belly aching and kind of sort of complaining and bitching behind each other's back and, you know, no agreed strategy. And what it needed was a kind of really firm hand at the tiller. And that's what Montgomery provides, you know, and he retrains his men properly. He says, okay, this is how we're going to do it. This is what we're going to do. Every man knows exactly what his role is. And of course, that makes a huge difference. You know, I want you to be physically fit and go and swim in the sea and get a good night's sleep and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, they all have done that. But the main thing is also is bringing up huge reserves of supplies. So, you know, maintenance warehouses, you know, workshops are out in the desert just behind. So, you know, a tank might get knocked out, but you pull it back overnight, get it into the workshop, you know, it's good to go again 2 days later. It's that kind of thing. So, you know, the efficiency of using what you've got is much, much, much improved. All of that is coming from other people, but it is the steering of Montgomery that kind of sort of leads to that build up of weight of force. And also it's the evolution of air power and the contribution that Desert Air Force and RAF Middle East plays, you know, which really shouldn't be underestimated. And, you know, and to be fair to Montgomery, he pays full credit to that.
Back home, Churchill called Alamein not the beginning of the end, but the end of the beginning. What do you make of that assessment in terms of its place in the wider war?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's just sort of good catchy rhetoric, isn't it? I mean, you know, it is a line in the sand, no pun intended, because it is a significant victory. You know, there's going to be no more reverses. I think Alamein is significant. It's not just because there's no more reverses in North Africa. It marks a sea change in approach, how you go about fighting. You know, just around the corner is going to be Operation Torch. Within a matter of days of the end of the Battle of Alamein, which will see a combined US-Anglo force land in northwest Africa, in Algiers and Morocco, and push towards Tunisia. And the idea is going to be squeeze the Axis forces out in a pincer in Tunisia, which ultimately does happen. So it's a sea change. You know, it's a moment where the Allies are just going to win. You know, no one knows how long it's going to take or what form it's going to take and how it's going to play out. But it's very hard to see how the Germans can recover from this. So that's why it's so important. And, you know, it's treated as the kind of huge victory that it is back in England with the permission of everyone to ring the church bells for the first time since the start of the war. So, You know, it's a major, major victory. I mean, you know, it should never be belittled. It really is very important. And I think it's very important for kind of self-belief from the British point of view that this is a British victory, or Commonwealth, Duke forces, British, you know, Dominion, UK and Empire forces, beating the Germans and Italians fair and square, which is the first time this has happened. I mean, there's been battles where the Germans have been kicked back, but this is, they're absolutely destroyed. And who thought that could happen when they were being retreated from going down on the ships from Dunkirk back in late May 1940?
And so finally, James, let's finish how we're finishing all of these episodes with a little bit of alternate history. So what might have happened, do you think, if things had gone the other way at Alamein?
Well, I think for that to have happened, that would have had to have happened in July 1942 when Rommel first brings his Panzer Army up to the Alamein line. Had they got through, well, you know, Egypt would have fallen. The Suez Canal would have been in Axis hands and they would have got to the Middle East. So it would have been, you know, it would have been catastrophic. As I say, you know, Britain didn't need the Middle East oil because the Middle East oil was just supporting operations in the Middle East. But the Germans certainly did. I mean, whether it would have altered the war, the outcome of the war, I doubt very much. But it would have been a major setback, that's for sure.
That was James Holland speaking to me, Ellie Cawthorne. James is a military historian and the author of several books on the Second World War, including Together We Stand, which looks at the North African campaign in much more depth. He's also the co-founder of the Chalk History Festival, which runs from the 24th to the 30th of June this year. As a media partner of the festival, we're offering an exclusive 15% off day tickets for subscribers to either historyextra.com or BBC History Magazine. Check out this offer and other benefits at historyextra.com/pod.